Hi, everybody. Welcome to Defy and Hustle. This is Noreen, and I'm here today with my co-host, the beautiful Kelly Trepanier.
Hey, everybody.
And I also have here, working the controls over here, Josh.
Hi, guys. What's going on?
I gotta
do some things. One second.
Sorry. Okay, Josh. Sorry to bother you. And I want to know, Kelly, are you part of the BTS universe?
Oh, well, Noreen, I have to tell you, I'm not. That was the first time I actually heard their song, but I instantly wanted to be like, oh, yeah. But I can't say I'd ever want it again on my radio.
Okay. Well, that song that was just on is a song by this group called BTS, and this group apparently, now I'm older, but this group has apparently taken the world by storm. They were just on Saturday Night Live this week, but I think this is way after the fact. The girls in the audience were cheering like crazy. But it is a boy band that has been voted one of the most influential, top 50 influential people, even though it's a group, in the world. And they've just taken over social media. And there's seven of them.
I know, but why? Why have they taken over social media?
I'm not. Well, you're younger than me, Kelly. Josh, did you know who?
No,
BTS
I had no idea who that was.
Okay, well,
I think you might have to be younger than Josh and I to know them.
The BTS stands for Beyond the Scene, and they are known for their large social media presence. And BTS was the most retweeted celebrities in the world for 2017 and 2018, and they got. Let's see, it was reported that BTS brought $3.6 billion into the Korean economy last year, and that one in every 13 foreigners who visit South Korea are doing so because of them. So,
well, they're clearly doing something right.
Oh, Kelly.
What?
Oh, man. Okay, well, there's something known. This is social media, folks, and we're talking about influence tonight, and we're talking about social media, so there is something known as the BTS effect, as it was termed by various news outlets, and they have such influence. BTS holds the Guinness World Book record for the most Twitter engagements, and to date they have spent 117 weeks on the Billboard Social 50 chart, and basically they've taken over all of even the United States music culture. So if you don't know who BTS is, you should know, and you can check them out.
I know who Halsey is. That's who the song was featured with.
Oh, because they started, the song is even in Korean, but they started to make music with Ariana Grande.
Really?
Halsey's a pop star right now, right?
Yeah.
I'll date myself. But they're huge. They're absolutely huge, and their song will stick in your ear. So that's why I put BTS out there today, folks, to try and show how cool I am. But also because we are going to be talking with our guest today about social media influence, and that's not the exact topic of their book, but their topic is about social media influence.
It covers an aspect of it, of also dealing with it. We're kind of in this epidemic of experts, and that all you really have to be is an influencer on social media to claim that you are an expert and give all this advice that sometimes can actually be really detrimental without even realizing it to the public. So that's definitely a part of the topic as we're going to dive in on the subject of you're doing it wrong.
Yes. So we have two beautiful, intelligent women on the phone that are the authors of the book, You're Doing It Wrong, Mothering, Media, and Medical Expertise. And we have on the phone with us today Professor Bethany Johnson. And we also have Dr. Margaret Quinlan. And they are they there, Josh?
Sure, yes.
Hi, ladies.
Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for being on with us today. And why don't you, we'll start out just by telling people, how did you come up with the title, You're Doing It Wrong?
Well, I will say that that's been a joke that Maggie and I have had for years. I just left a voicemail this morning about a very unfortunate napkin incident at our house. And I said, here's my doing it wrong story for today. and it was also something that we started talking about because we felt like we were getting that message everywhere. Maggie studies health communication, so she's well aware of how the public perceives messages about medicine and healthcare. And I'm a historian and I study medical history. So we come at it from different angles, but we've both been watching the "you're doing it wrong" message. We can easily trace it back about 150 years.
that people have been doing it wrong, or it's been implied
that
to them?
No matter what people did, they were told they were doing it wrong. And for your listeners, please rest assured, we will not tell you you're doing it wrong in our book. The book is about how no matter what caretakers do, particularly mothers, they will be told they're doing it wrong. What does this look like over history, and how has that intensified in the social media age? And, you know, some things that we can do about it. So we don't give our expertise on parenting or pregnancy or infertility treatment or any of those things. We do tell our own stories, but we are not here saying you're doing it wrong. We are here saying we know that you're being told that, and this is how to bolster yourself against it a little bit.
So this is a book about mothering, media, and medical expertise. So why did you feel that it was important to put it into historical context?
I think, well, the historian in me says, well, everything has to be put in historical context. but for me, I think it does a very specific thing. When I'm feeling really nervous, or when I'm feeling anxious, or when I'm up at 2 a.m. and my baby has a fever and I'm not sure why and I can't call the doctor or reach out to anybody, I've looked at archives of letters between friends that wrote each other in the 1860s saying, I had a long night, my baby had a fever. And it gives me a space to there are a long line of people that have been here, through that have gotten through this, that have experienced this. I can do this.
So there's a lot of us I know that may have been going through something emotional, and we go now quickly to the internet and Google, and we start putting in words, and we start looking for something to tell us everything's okay. But a lot of times when you get there, it doesn't feel like you're connecting.
But I mean, it's also kind of like when you see even influencers and celebrities, they post a picture of their daughter who got into their makeup case and who's just having fun, and everyone jumps back and is like, you're a bad parent, you're not doing this right. And motherhood, being a female, just being alive in today's world, puts us all in a very vulnerable state where we often can feel that we're already not doing good enough. And then to be in that sensitive time in your life and to have these strangers and doctors and friends and families telling you that you're doing something wrong when you're really just doing the best you can must be, I mean, it is a huge issue, and it's great that you guys have written this book. And I love that it's not advice, but really just painting this broad picture of a pattern in society that if we begin to research and understand can maybe change the conversation that we're having with one another.
That's absolutely it, Kelly. That's really what we're trying to do. What we've been able to isolate in this book is that we continue to focus on the individual, as if that one influencer mother didn't let her daughter touch makeup, that would change everything. But we're actually looking for more structural changes to allow more people to have more choices. And the individual focus, it's so much easier to tell one person they're doing it wrong than to change something that would make it easier for everyone. And so one of the reasons that Maggie and I have found that people seem to go after mothers, we talk, Maggie, it's in the last chapter, right, where you talk about the Kristen Cavallari post where she posts a picture of her sons on the 4th of July, and actually people posted under it, those children are malnourished. And I just saw these comments and I wanted to be like, oh, please tell me more about your degree in nutrition and your ability to diagnose nutritive disorders
from
over an Instagram picture with a filter on it. Like, you don't know these people, And, you know, and there are other people that will say, well, she put her public self out there. But this happens to pregnant women at the grocery store. Let's not pretend this is just happening to you, and you're not, Kelly. But, you know, for someone kind of hearing me and resisting this a little bit, well, they're influencers. Well, I've had people comment on what I'm putting in my grocery cart at the grocery store as a pregnant woman. That's
so what's
happening.
Like,
what's
that happening blows my mind, them? Though. It's like no one comments on what I put on mine. But so just because you're pregnant, it's like, oh, excuse me. You should not be eating this.
Right. Well, my body belongs to everyone now, right? Because I'm reproducing the state. I'm producing the next generation of people that are going to live here and be leaders in the society. So now everyone can have a say in what it looks like for me to do that, even though none of those people want to offer me assistance in making it easier most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not pointing the finger at
what Bethany puts in her mouth when she's pregnant affects the future generation of her family, you know, for the next 150 years, you know, and so Everybody feels they have to say something about what she's ingesting or not ingesting in her body.
So,
and what we found is most of the people saying you shouldn't ingest this, they are actually spreading myths from the late 19th century about nutrition. So if you actually trace back what most people are saying, it isn't actually held up by current data. And there are other people, public health economists like Emily Oster, who write about that.
Well, give me an example of something that has been carried forward.
So now people will be told you shouldn't eat spicy food unless you want to go into labor.
Kellogg, is that a superstition?
And also, spicy food doesn't put you into labor. Your body puts you into labor. There's a chemical release that puts you into labor, and you have very little control over that, unfortunately. That's why women will say, I've eaten 3 pineapples, I've done this many positions on this ball, I've eaten spicy food, I had XYZ, and still not in labor. And they post this on the internet, and some people will comment, yeah, well, it'll have frustrating, but... So this idea about not having spicy food actually goes back to Dr. Kellogg of Kellogg's Corn Flakes, who thought that eating spicy food and tea and coffee would actually make you, it would excite your passions and make you a morally repugnant person.
And you're saying it doesn't?
That's crazy. I eat a lot of hot sauce. I don't know. Maybe I'm a morally repugnant person, but... So we see a lot of these things bubbling up, but I have the training to go back and figure out where those things came from. But other people having to receive these comments from their friends and family and people in the grocery store and on the internet, they don't have that training. So how do they know that it might be given, you know, with concern but totally out of context?
Mm-hmm.
So in your book, you really cover the life cycle of early motherhood. So can you explain to our audience what that means? And why don't you start to get into the beginning of the life cycle, once you define it for us, and talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions around that.
Maggie, do you want to talk a little bit about preconception? I know that you and I have had a lot of conversations about that.
Sure. So we started off, our research together started off with issues related to infertility and doctor-patient communication around that. And once we began on that journey, we really thought, okay, the conversation really starts at conception. So, you know, when does conception begin? That's actually a stage, like the conception stage, before you can even get into, fertility challenges, pregnancy behavior and outcomes, you know, issues related to premature birth or infant loss or postpartum health issues, with raising toddlers. And so we kind of broke apart, conception all the way through the toddler years into different stages and talked about different crises or different crisis moments that are possible, why individuals would go to social media for health advice or go to a doctor for advice and trying to make sense of those moments. And, you know, why is it in those moments that people were trying to find, you know, advice and being told all of these conflicting ideas, and no matter what you do, you're still doing something wrong.
And even while we were studying it, the list lifespans got longer and longer. So we are finding teenage girls being considered to be in the preconceptive stage. So let's hold up for a minute. First of all, we're assuming that everyone wants to have children, which we should not assume and is not fair because there are people that don't want to have children. That's a totally valid choice. If you don't want to have children, don't have children. That's great. And then we're assuming everyone can have children, right? And there's people that if that's not, they're not going to biologically have children. They might adopt, they might foster, they might welcome children into their home, into their family, into their life in a different way. So this whole construction of being a preconceptive body, it's already leaving people out and already not telling the whole story about how families and communities are made in our culture. But it also begins to put pressure on people right away. So we found a list in some online magazines of 17 things that you should be doing. Are you getting enough sleep? Are you exercising enough? Have you had genetic testing? Are you having too much caffeine? Are you drinking too much? You know, just so many things that I just thought, wow, this sounds really unpleasant.
There's a really interesting point there, Bethany, is that when I was raised, never did anyone ever talk about the chance that you might not even be able to conceive and infertility struggles. Right. And I, in my head, although I am one of those women that never have really desired children, I still never think that I wouldn't be able to have them. And it, there's that subtle point of that if we're not really exposed to that and everyone is just like, you have children and this is, it goes this way and this is how it happens, and then it doesn't happen that way for you, that pressure that you can put on yourself and already start to feel like, oh, well, something's wrong with me. And then you get into this vulnerable state, which then we begin to search for all these experts to help us. Mm-hmm. But again, then there's no right way, wrong way, and we're in this circle of confusion and self-deprecation, or you know, disgust with ourselves,
or these, or these. I remember when I was in my 30s, there was a lot of the Hollywood starlets that were coming out and talking about how they were getting pregnant at 40 and 45, and it still goes on today. And I think that misled a lot of women. I was very much a career woman. I think it misled a lot of us to think that there would be no problem by the time we got to that age that we'd be able to have babies. But I think that they maybe weren't telling us just how much help they were getting with the infertility behind the scenes.
Yeah, this is something that Maggie and I have talked about a lot. And there was a lot of conversation around whether Beyonce used IVF to become pregnant with her twins, and some talk about whether or not she was going to talk about, you know, whether or not she had had experienced pregnancy loss. And as a researcher who deals in public spaces, I felt really conflicted about this because, frankly, it's not my business what Beyonce does. And also, she has a really wide and, you know, committed following. And you know, the things that she has said on these topics have made a huge impact. So whenever I see someone who is, you know, 45, I know the chance per menstrual cycle is something less than 2%.
Less than 2%.
That you would conceive without any intervention.
Uh-huh.
And so my brain says, oh, there was probably some assisted reproductive technology there. It'd be so neat to hear about that. And I think that hits close to my heart because our research started, Maggie and I, researching a different topic during a failed IVF cycle that I had. And I had a really hard conversation through voicemail tag with a practitioner, an embryologist, who was trying to give me hard news, and it didn't go very well. We couldn't get in touch. The whole communication broke down pretty spectacularly. And I remember Maggie was pregnant at the time, and she's such a tender friend and beautiful support and just the greatest colleague you could ever want. And she said, you know, do you need to go home? And I said, no, I need to work because I need to not think about something I can't control, which is my embryos failing in a lab somewhere. And I remember on the drive home, we were in New York City doing work. I said, I just wish, you know, there was something we can do about this. And she very kindly said, oh, that's what I do. Instead, we should do a study. So we interviewed 27 people all over the country and got 900 pages of transcript. And this was the first thread of our book, because this is where we started hearing people saying that Dr. Google. This is where we started hearing people saying, I'm texting my nurse. I follow this infertility doctor on Instagram. So from the very beginning, the story that we're telling in this book wanted to come out. We just had a lot of other projects to do before we could concentrate on this. But our friendship, our narratives, our losses and successes are woven into this book, too.
So you two are both at the University of North Carolina. And just explain briefly once again, Justin, because we got into the book very quickly, what your two roles are there and how you did befriend each other. And let's just go from there, and then let's go further into the book and some of the other sections of the book.
Sure. So we actually met through Bethany's real estate agent was my neighbor, and we were both living in Charlotte at the time, so we're at UNC Charlotte, and she met Bethany and said, oh, you know, the two of you need to meet, and within, she had us over for dinner, Julie Walburis, and you know, we just had this, like, delightful time, and the two of us just, you know, just connected so quickly. And, you know, by the end of the dinner, we had already, you know, started to think of, you know, research projects that we could work on together. And so I think I have been at UNC Charlotte for now 10 years. And Bethany, is this your fifth year?
Yeah, it's been my fifth year doing a wide variety of part-time or full-time positions or appointments, and I'm in the Department of History, and I do medical history and women's and gender history, and I focus on epidemics as well, and Maggie does a lot of rhetorical work and health communication in the Communication Studies Department, so we have a really neat mix of our own type of expertise that we can bring to the research, and we used all of that in this book. So we did archival research. We quote from letters in the Clemson family of the university, you know, Clemson University. We did a radian 6 analysis and studied millions of data points of certain words to find out how these
words analysis?
Were. It's called radian 6. Maggie, that is, it's really a quantitative collector, right?
Yeah, it's a stuff. It gathers public social media posts.
Okay.
So for each of our topics, we typed in postpartum depression or something, and it would pull up within the last, you know, week or 2 weeks, everything that had been tweeted, everything that was on Facebook.
Fascinating.
You know, it doesn't pull Instagram images, which got a little tricky, but so, you know, we were able to collect data really quickly that way, which was fun. Yeah.
So actually, stick with postpartum for a second. That's one of the four stages of the life cycle of early motherhood, right? So postpartum. Now, I read the chapters in your book that talked about, it's the name of the chapter is called Not Just the Baby Blues. But why don't you talk to us about postpartum and some of the issues facing women, facing families, facing husbands, and...
Well, and I was
the medical system. Yeah.
When we were on the phone with you, Bethany, of discovering that the U.S. is one of like the highest developed countries for infant
mortality.
Maternal death.
One of the highest for infant death at birth, and the highest in the industrialized world for maternal death. Not only the highest, but it has been on the rise for the last 10 years.
It's the highest in the world,
and on the rise.
The highest in the industrialized
maternal death.
World. Yeah, maternal death. The highest in the industrialized world, and it continues to increase year over year for more than a decade.
And
now.
Why did you?
Well, we quote a doctor in the book who said, you know, childbirth is like taking the candy out of the wrapper, and then you discard the wrapper. So the real issue is that if you've had a cesarean section, you are likely to be seen once to have your incision checked, but that's not going to be an in-depth health meeting. You're meeting with a surgeon who's checking their work. Women who give birth vaginally or through a C-section, they don't have a normal baseline check-in until 6 weeks after they leave the hospital. The vast majority of maternal deaths in the U.S. happen at 6 weeks and before. So we are literally sending people home, and some of them die. And that is because we assume that once they leave the hospital after 2 or 3 days, they are fine. And women are very strong and women are very capable. But as I've seen in memes on the internet, and I think, you know, medical people will tell you this is true, it's like getting in a car accident, and then after 2 days of recovery, they hand you someone else who was in that car accident with you, and you have to go home and make sure that they get well. And you don't have any resources unless you have people that can come into your home. But there's an expectation, right? There's an expectation that you bounce back right away, that your body bounces back, that your marriage bounces back, that you just sort of glide into all of these new roles with no issue. And so we thought, you know, when Maggie and I were talking about this and doing these Radiant 6 searches and interviewing people, we thought we were going to talk about the history of the concept of postpartum depression. And pretty quickly we realized we needed to be talking about why people were dying. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in the archives at Francis Collins Library at the Harvard Medical School. And I got to look at the outpatient casebooks from the Boston Lion Hospital from 1905. These were immigrant women who were poor, mostly from Italy or the Jewish areas of Russia. So they would have called it, you know, beyond the pale. So these were very poor people who came to this country for a different life, and they got free care. They had their babies at home with a doctor, and the doctor came back every 12 hours or then every day for weeks to make sure mother and child were well. And I would have just died for that kind of care after I had one of my babies.
So what happened with you? What kind of care do most women get?
Well, you go home or 3 days after, and then you don't see anyone for 6 weeks. No one calls and checks. You can't get seen unless you can demonstrate that you have an infection. So we had one woman that we interviewed from a major city who didn't get seen at all after she gave birth to her second child. And after 40 hours of not even seeing a medical practitioner after the birth, she had her doctor call the hospital and insist someone look at her body and then let her go home. And then because she had never really been checked, she had to lie and say, I think I have an infection, so that she could just have someone look at her body. This is a high-power corporate woman. This is not a woman you would expect to be in this situation. But what Maggie and I found so interesting is that she said, yeah, so I had pretty good care.
So people go home, and this happens a lot whether you're pregnant or not, but you're dealing with physical symptoms, and you're not really sure if they're normal or not. So, right. And there's this expectation, I think, that because childbirth is natural, that there's mm-hmm. just that women just deal with it. They know what they're doing, and they'll just deal with it.
I'm curious, and I don't really think there's necessarily an answer here because we're in the midst of it, but I remember reading in your book that in New England, you know, this postpartum care was anywhere from these short-term 4 days, but up to months.
Yeah.
And like mm-hmm. you're saying, that they're really dedicated in doctor visits. So there's clearly been this huge drop-off, and I like that metaphor, the candy in the wrapper. But if we're seeing these mortality rates rising, why are we not making a change to our new mother, you know, after pregnancy care in our health system?
Why isn't the medical community responding?
I think
go ahead, Maggie.
Both of us is that the blame gets put on the woman, and that's a really mm-hmm. easy sort of scapegoat, that you could have done more things to get in a better situation. You know, could have had family come in, or, you know, we know that our terrible maternity leaves in the United States are connected to depression. And, you know, mm-hmm. that's why I think, you know, we do a good job in the book of, you know, talking about how baby blues is different than postpartum depression, that, you know, sort of baby blues is this white idea that, you know, that everybody, you know, it's difficult for everyone, mm-hmm. right? But
it might be the first time you realize you don't matter. Yeah.
Well, and that ties back into the title, You're Doing It Wrong, which is kind of putting mm-hmm. the blame on the mothers. And there's this interesting thing you said, Bethany, is that the conversation, how did you put it? The subjects, that we're talking about, like the conversation has maybe changed, the words have changed, but the message mm-hmm. is still the same between this patient yep. and practitioner conversation. And just as Maggie, you were saying, it's like, well, it's kind of like your fault. You didn't know how to mm-hmm. take care of yourself and check up. Doctors so often say it's like, well, you can't get pregnant because you're too stressed or you need to uh-huh. relax.
Why don't you relax? Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and with the postpartum piece, you know, if you have to say, I think I might have an infection to have a doctor see you, we also, there's this issue that when women think, and this happened with Serena Williams, when you know that something is wrong, so Serena Williams has had blood clot issues and has taken, I believe, heparin for it before. She knew she had a blood clot after she gave birth to her daughter. Serena Williams, pretty well-known person, pretty powerful person, pretty fit person. I think we can all agree that she's pretty amazing. She told doctors and nurses all over her ward, and all of them said, oh, it's just baby blues. She finally had to crawl to the nurse's desk and say, you need to give me an MRI. I have a blood clot. She had such a massive blood clot. She had to go right into surgery. She ended up being in bed for 6 weeks. There were tons of issues with her baby nursing and doing all this stuff. So part of this, the problem is that women may know something is wrong, but they have to get someone to believe them. And if you're at home and you're not even around a medical professional and you're looking at your mom or your friend and you're saying, something just doesn't feel right, usually people just tell you it's just baby blues, as if that's not a hard thing, A. But B, if we really are still stuck in this issue of just not believing women when they know that something is wrong.
And then they're emotional. They're emotional.
Right. You're hysterical. You have neurasthenia. Like, that's what we would have said in the 19th century, in the 1800s. Today we'll say, well, maybe you're just too anxious. You're too stressed. Are you menstruating? You know, all of those things are just newer versions of something we said before.
I don't even think I understood up until the last few decades that women went through something called postpartum, that they actually got depressed after they had babies. And I'm also fascinated by men in these conflicting roles, even though they may have paternity leave now, there's probably a lot of peer pressure on them to not take it. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
My partner definitely had... technically has 4 weeks of paternity leave, which for America is good, unfortunately. but there was kind of, you know, 2 weeks was really all that was going to happen. And 2 weeks with some going in late at night and everything. And I think it's different job to job and company to company. But, you know, it can be really helpful to have a partner of any gender expression at home with you after you have a baby, just another set of hands and eyes. The thing that I didn't realize about postpartum, you know, Maggie, maybe you didn't either. I didn't understand why they were sending me home with these diaper underwear. I didn't understand that I wasn't going to be able to stand up straight for a couple of weeks, how tired I would be because I never got caught up on the sleep I lost during being in labor for 27 hours. I didn't know that I would be... that I'll be bleeding for weeks, and that's normal. These are things that they kind of give you all in a bunch of pamphlets right before you leave the hospital. But, you know, things seem very... Also, if you're trying to keep someone alive, everything seems mm-hmm. very critical in those days. And I would have loved to have had a doctor show up and be like, hey, this baby's doing well. Or, do you need a cup of tea? Have a seat here. You really are doing all right. Not doing it wrong.
Really?
You have someone do that.
This is the first time when you have a baby for the first time, you don't even, you're so busy trying to interpret what's mm-hmm. going on with the baby and making sure the baby's okay that you're putting yourself second. And mm-hmm. it's, I mean, I don't know firsthand, but it's, I'm thinking that even if you catch a cold as a regular person, anybody, male, female, if you catch a cold or, you know, you catch the flu or something like that, you're just knocked off your feet. Even if you get a bad night's mm-hmm. sleep, you're knocked off your feet. But mm-hmm. to be pregnant for 9 months, then give birth, be in labor, and then have this to take care of yourself and take care of your new baby and potentially be taking care of other children or other family yeah. members, it must just be overwhelming. And I think I can tell you very honestly, until I really started to read your material, I never gave it much of any thought. And I don't think a lot of our culture does. Yeah, it's a private thing.
And it's just such a fascinating and large topic. And as you were saying that, I mean, women and that story about Serena Williams, it's just like, wow, something's wrong. But it's our job to actually get them to believe us, to get a doctor to believe us, to listen to us. And I know that our readers or listeners outside of just pregnancy can totally relate to that. Noreen and I were having a conversation about our doctors the other day, and it's, I suffer from something called cyclical vomiting syndrome, but it's never happening in any time I'm in front of a doctor.
Right. And then you start to question yourself.
Half the time, they just don't believe me. And I'm like, something's not right. I need to figure this out. Like, you're fine. You look fine. And it takes months to even try and see someone, and they just kind of brush you under the rug. And so I get it from a doctor's perspective. I get it that WebMD has changed the conversation in the doctor's office, and that there are hysterical people, but you still, it's your oath. Like, you need to listen. And I wonder, we talked a little bit about doulas, that perhaps there's an avenue.
Doulas. Yeah. I'm just making sure the audience knows what you're talking
doulas,
about.
They're birthing guides. Maggie, would you like to maybe express or teach us a little bit about doulas? And then the potential that they might be able to fill this void and take the time for aftercare during those 6 weeks of pregnancy.
Well, for example, when my first child was born, I did an incorrect breastfeeding position, and so we were in the hospital, and my husband came back in the room, and the baby had turned blue, and so they had to resuscitate her in front of us, and then she was whisked to the NICU.
Oh my God.
And so because of that, I had a lot of breastfeeding anxiety because I had just smothered my poor baby, right? And, you know, the idea that nobody called to say, how are you doing? Or could a lactation consultant come to the house to see how you're doing it in your bed or on your couch? You know, because they have you go to them. And
but that's not where you're breastfeeding, right? Yeah.
Yeah, for, you know, for lactation help. And so, you know, having a doula there, which I was not able to have, you know, with health insurance and things, it was not something we were able to do. But sort of to have somebody there to, you know, to guide us through things that were scary, you know, would have been really helpful.
And I had a doula come and help me after both babies. Her name is Julie. Hello, Julie, our angel, and we really needed her the second time because I got home with a two-day-old baby, and my daughter came home from school that day with 103 fever and croup, and that will kill a newborn. So I had to figure out, and so we spent the whole 2 weeks trying to keep our family on different floors. I ended up getting bronchitis when my baby was 72 hours old. I had to have chest x-rays. So just imagine you've had a vaginal birth and you're coughing 600 or 700 times a day.
There's
nothing
we
can give you because you're nursing a baby.
Oh, they can't give you medicine.
Yeah.
Well, you can't. It's not like they can give you cough syrup with codeine.
Right.
My sister's a nurse. I called her and she was like, get some Teflon Pearl and telling you some other things. But the thing that was so helpful about the doula was that doulas aren't just there helping you with laundry and cooking and saying, let me hold the baby. Please go take a shower. Do you need me to come help? You step out of the shower. Can I help you get dressed? You know, do you need me to run and get that from Target for you? And my doula who was at my birth, Emily, I had gestational diabetes. She had also had gestational diabetes. She was able to talk me through everything and say, this is what will happen. I'll tell you this at this point. You can always say this with the doctor and let them know X. It's a friendly person who can see things that you can't see because you're overwhelmed. So they can see warning signs about your health. They can see if you're swelling around your ankles all of a sudden. Maybe you have post-eclampsia. You need to get to the hospital. You might not notice that because you're just so tired and spent. A doula can do that. But something Maggie and I talk about in the book is doulas have to be paid for. And so who gets to have a doula? Only the people that can pay for them. In other countries, doulas are provided as part of the healthcare system. So it's baffling to us in a country where women are dying at the highest rate in the industrialized world, and insurance companies won't even consider offering doula coverage because that could alone lower the maternal death rate. And it's not because doulas have medical answers and because they're treating people. It's because they of a...
Because they're there and they can see the signs.
Right. You might say, oh, you're spiking a little bit of a temperature. This could be an infection. Let's make sure you get to the doctor today. Do you want me to come with you? I'll help you hold the baby. You know, where's your partner? Is your mom in town? You know, like, they can help you do all those things. You're swelling a little bit here. Let's get you some water. If it doesn't go down, let's call your doctor.
It's called, you know? It seems like it's called care. Like, what we don't have in our culture anymore. Everybody's so busy just trying to get by and meeting other demands that we don't have the proper care.
Don't care, right? They're having to do this too.
Yeah, everybody's just trying to get by.
Let's make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's tough, and it's also a tough place to insert yourself into because it's so intimate. But I wanted to just remind our listeners, we're on the phone right now with the authors of the book, You're Doing It Wrong, Mothering, Media, and Medical Expertise. We have on Professor Bethany Johnson, who's a historian, and she's the lead author. And we have also Dr. Margaret Quinlan, and they're both out of the University of North Carolina, and Dr. Quinlan is in communication studies. But ladies, because we've got a few minutes left, I wanted to come back around. Would you say that this is a book for parenting, or is it an advice book?
Mm-hmm. And Maggie, you might have a different take, which would be good, because I love that we can both bring a take to it. I think this is a book for anyone interested in media communication, the history of medicine, or wants to hear some really wild stories about how the NICU started on Coney Island. I really think that just about anybody could read this book and find something interesting and unexpected in it. It is not a parenting or an advice book, but it is a story about how we navigate medical expertise in social media and the roots of that in the 19th century newspaper and magazine media age.
Okay, and do you think, so Kelly and I were talking before this about just even backing up to the name of the show, Defy and Hustle, mm-hmm. how we could relate to the defiant side of the Defy and Hustle is to try to stop and think for yourself for a moment mm-hmm. and really narrow down your decisions and what's important to you and making sure those needs are met versus listening to this onslaught of information that's coming in at us all the time. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the reason I came up with the terminology defy, which is stop searching and looking everywhere and really just think for yourself and get your needs met. And so I guess my question for you has to do with, so you're taking a good look at this around how it's affecting women and women in the motherhood stage. But it's just pervasive, right? It's affecting all of us at some level or another.
Absolutely. And I think for me, this book potentially would help anybody going through any kind of health issue, or you know, even Kelly's example about this, you know, the cyclical issue she was having or has about how to complicate the conversations that you're having with the medical system. So, you know, like for me, when I'm in something, you know, I go to Bethany and, you know, this is what the doctor said to me. And this is, you know, what's going on. And, you know, and she can always help me sort of ground it into, okay, this is the message that women or men or trans individuals have been given throughout history. And, you know, to sort of help give you some critical thinking skills to try to make sense of the messages that we're getting.
Mm-hmm. And I do definitely want to reiterate that you don't have to be a mother or even wanting to get pregnant to enjoy this book. There are
exactly.
some wild stories and fascinating history. And
fascinating
just,
history.
Like Maggie was saying, is that it really teaches us this discussion of the healthcare profession, these conversations we're having. And as Noreen was relating to, it's like to defy kind of the status quo and to then take mm-hmm. a good look at the decisions that we try to make. And that's recognizing that when we're looking for advice, we're in a vulnerable state. And right. to take that into acknowledgement before you just digest and swallow the information coming at you and take the time to really study what it is you're after and trying to gain from the questions that you're seeking, and ask, you know, your friends and community as well, that you trust, and, you know, have a sounding board to jump off of.
I think women, we often, another phrase I use around, when I'm coaching people, has to do with honoring your worth. And I think women, mm-hmm. we're culturally defined to not, to doubt ourselves. I guess I want to come at it that way.
Yeah.
To doubt ourselves and say, well, it must be okay because nobody's making a big deal out of it, and I won't speak up for myself because it's, why don't we rationalize our way out of it?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. so, well, how do you feel? Do you, right? You must have some experience with that, especially as mothers are coming and questioning whether they should be feeling a certain way.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we learned on social media is that the people in the comment section might be very confident, but they're not in the room with you and your child. They don't know you and your child. They don't know your medical history. They don't know medical history, period, most of the time. They're not your doctor.
That's true.
So it's fine for them to be confident. Social media is a, in most senses, a democratic space where people can come and give their opinion. The problem is when you're having a crisis and you're reaching out for help, we tend to trust the people that are most confident, but that has no relationship with how right they are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All these experts on television with the big egos may be certifiably crazy, but they're very convincing.
Right.
So
in a moment of crisis, you might be like, okay, this person is confident, I'm going to try this. And that comes up a lot in motherhood, or, you know, in Kelly, in your case, if you're having an odd medical problem and you can't get a traditional medical practitioner to take you seriously or understand, you're going to want to hear from anybody that has something to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
And parsing out what you can trust is much harder, I think, than people think.
It is. So I'd love for our listeners to know that you're doing it wrong. Mothering Discourses, Social Media, and the History of Medical Expertise is available now. You guys, you can get it off Amazon. You can also get it off Rutgers. Is that correct, ladies?
Rutgers, yep. University Press.
University Press. And I think there's still that 30% discount if you go to Rutgers. Is there anywhere else?
Barnes & Noble. And if people just want to Google it, they don't have to remember you're doing it wrong, Mothering Media Medical Expertise. If they put into Google, you're doing it wrong, mothering, that'll get you there.
All right.
So what is the most you got out of this book, ladies? So now you're done writing. How long did it take you to do the book, write the book?
We've been doing some of the research for 5 years.
5 years.
But some of the conclusions to the chapters we had to keep rewriting because technology keeps changing.
Yeah, right? If you don't keep up with it, and if you were having babies while you were writing the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I came away with, and Maggie really helped me with this, I kind of joke about it as the reconnaissance method of social media. I get in, I get what I need, and I get out, especially if I'm seeing issues that are hitting too close to home or too close to something that's going on with me that I don't know if I can hear all the loud voices about and still hear my own at the center of it. So sometimes I just have to stop using it. And that historical arc, understanding of the things I'm wrestling with are the things that parents and caretakers and individuals and women have been wrestling with forever. So I'm not alone in the history of humans, and I'm going to be okay. That is the way.
And I think throughout the book, we're very also aware of our own, you know, privilege as white,
absolutely,
cisgender, heterosexual, you know, middle class women.
Mm-hmm.
And so throughout it, you know, we complicate our own experiences and, you know, realizing the complexities for people who identify differently, and try, you know, throughout the book to really bring in those voices. And we had a lot of great conversations with people who identify as mothers, very different from our experience, which I think really brings this book to life and really gives it that depth that as we're going through the stages, other people gave us insights to their own lives that helped, you know, help to push us in different directions that we never envisioned the book would go.
Right. How can we advocate for people that don't have access to the things that we have access to in the position that we have in society? Our work always has to come back to that, and we learn a lot that way.
Well, ladies, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. Your
Thank
the
you
book
having.
is intelligent, it's informative, it's eye-opening, and I really am thrilled that women like you are out there. It's objective, and so I want everybody to go and look for the book You're Doing It Wrong, Mothering Discourses, Social Media, and the History of Medical Expertise. And I really liked what you said about when we go onto the internet and start searching for answers when we're in a fearful place, that is not the time to, it's the time you're going to do it, but to also remember that's the worst time to do it.
Ladies, thank you so much for
joining
us.
We're
going
to have to sign off on our end, but regards from Greenwich down to Charlotte, and
Define
thank you very much.
Define Hustle Radio.
Yeah, Define Hustle Radio signing off. Bye-bye, everybody.
You're listening to the Voice.